Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy.
Presented by the Mary Lou Lemon Foundation.
So the deal is done. The State House's ruling troika, Governor Kevin Stitt, Senate President Greg Treat, and House Speaker Charles McCall, finally hammered out the details on an education funding package they hailed as historic. Well, pardon the cynicism, but when the powers that be proclaim something is historic, it's usually anything but. To help us unpack the agreement that, yes, includes teacher pay raises and paid maternity leave, but also, vouchers for private schools, we invited one of our favorite public policy gurus and co-founder of the Oklahoma Policy Institute, David Blatt, to help us separate the political rhetoric from the public policy reality, and to help us see clearly the missed opportunities amidst unprecedented bounty in the state's bank accounts. So, David, great to have you. First up, can you update our listeners about what you're doing post-OK Policy, for those who don't know?
Sure. Left OK Policy at the end of 2019 and started teaching in the public administration program at OU Tulsa in January 2020. So I've just finished up my first semester of my fourth year, I guess, and it's been now 4 years that I have not had to step foot in the Capitol more than I was there last week, but it was the first time I'd been there since 2020. And I feel, you know, fully disinfected now, but it's definitely easier to observe these issues from a distance sometimes.
And you look 10 years younger, may I say. So that is, I can't believe it's been 4 years though. Good Lord. Wow. Well, you know, my hair's turning grayer by the minute, I'm afraid. So what do you make of this thing? It does seem to have some reasonably decent features.
Yeah.
Let me ask right off the bat. I'm just really, have you looked at it closely enough to know whether this infusion of new money for public schools will make up the ground we lost through all, when you adjust for inflation and everything, from the tax cuts and so forth that began in the early 2010s?
It's hard to know exactly how to measure this. I think what's important is we've learned over the years that the legislature will take up education funding in a serious way intermittently. It's not something that has been done on an annual basis really since the mid-2000s. I think under the Henry administration, we saw successive years where there were teacher pay raises and more money for the formula and so on. And then we hit 2008 and the recession and the budget shortfalls of that. And there was really the lost decade that spanned from 2007, 2008, all the way till 2018, when they finally passed the major teacher pay raise that preceded the two-week teacher walkout. And that was, you know, an average over $6,000 pay raise, which recovered a good deal of the ground that had been lost over the decade, but not entirely. They did a small follow-up the next year, and then a few years passed again. We had the pandemic and budget shortfalls. And this year, they're in the process of giving final approval to another teacher pay raise, this time $3,000 to $6,000. I think they're saying the average is going to be about $4,800. So, you know, the good news is definitely that they're able to take this up again and pass a pretty substantial pay raise without an entire decade going by. This time it's been, you know, 4 or 5 years rather than 10 or 12 years. So definitely got to give them credit for that. Does that catch us up to where we would have been? Well, we've never funded education all that well in Oklahoma. So it's sort of hard to know what would be the appropriate baseline. From the reporting that I've seen, this raise may keep us fourth in the six or seven state region. Arkansas may in fact overtake us, but I think more important for teachers that have gone now again several years without a raise during a period of above average levels of inflation, which has certainly dipped substantially into purchasing power and raise expenses. I think this is a significant and important pay raise. Overall, I'd say, you know, often one looks at action by the legislature and can point out the good, the bad, and the ugly. I think there's a bunch of good here, but the new tax credits for private schools jumps all the way to ugly.
Well, you know what worries me the most about those? I mean, other than the fact that this is, this expands on the Nicole Henry. I mean, this is, you know, the camel's nose got under the tent with that. You know, we're getting more of the head under the tent here, not as far, obviously, as the privatizers want to go. But it sure,
you know, I'm going to take issue with you there, Arnold. Okay. I don't know that. I think they got pretty much the whole enchilada this year. This is now the third major private school funding program. So you mentioned the Lindsay Nicole Henry scholarship that was implemented about a decade ago. But that's limited to special education students who already are coming out of the private schools. The second major program, which was just expanded to $50 million 2 years ago, is a tax credit for people who make donations to scholarship granting organizations that then in turn can be used to subsidize kids attending private school. That program remains in effect with a $50 million cap, but this year they just passed $150 million, already scheduled to go up to $250 million to provide a tax credit of $5,000 to $7,500 per student to send any kid to any private school in the state. Absolute carte blanche on what the school is, who the student is. Now, they did put a cap in, but $150 million, that is a pretty substantial cap. So at this point, we have three different scholarship tax credit programs for private schools. There is not much more they can do. At some point, they can, and I'm sure will, increase the amount of the tax credit, particularly when, in all likelihood, private schools just go and raise the tuition and they find that $5,000 or $7,500 isn't covering as much tuition as they might have thought. But at some point, you know, they may look at increasing the amount per credit and either lifting or eliminating the overall cap on the tax credit. But they've pretty much got what they've been dreaming of now for years and years, going back at least to Mary Fallon, but arguably for, you know, the 50-year crusade to get public funds for religious education.
So did they put any guardrails on income, family income for these? Just for the listeners' knowledge.
Yes. So what they did is the amount of the tax credit, it is $7,500 if your income is below a certain threshold and $5,000 if your income is above. And I can't recall offhand where they set that, where the threshold is over which you would get the smaller amount. It's either $150,000 or $250,000, but I'd have to check on that. So if you are somebody who makes a million or, you know, more a year, you will only get a $5,000 tax credit, but you can be making pretty substantial money. You have three kids in private school. You've been paying whatever it is, $30,000, $35,000 for your three kids. Now you're going to get back over $20,000 as the state subsidy to send your kid to the Christian or Muslim or Jewish or other private school.
There's a lot of those other
private. They are, and they're almost all religious schools. And you know what is particularly disturbing about this, even compared to some other states that have implemented similar programs, either through a voucher or an education savings account or a tax credit, most of those have actually imposed certain reporting requirements and accountability requirements. Here in Oklahoma, we're having none of that. This is just a true blank check for pretty much any student to attend pretty much any private school. There will not be, the language of the legislation explicitly said that nothing in this bill will require any private school to do anything additional as a condition of accepting the tax credit, or, you know, having their students or their families be eligible. So we will not know what the curriculum is. We will not know. There will be no requirements in terms of teacher certification. There will be no requirements or standards in terms of the curriculum, in terms of testing, graduation rates, and so on. We know very little about private schools now. We will know just as little going forward.
Did homeschoolers get anything out of this?
They got a little. The homeschool organizations were pretty clear that they wanted no part of this. They were actually fairly vocal opponents of the proposals, fearing that this opens the door to state regulation of homeschools. Mm-hmm. And as you know, you guys know, and your listeners may know, Oklahoma is among a very small handful of states that has absolutely no tracking of students in who are being homeschooled, which is the way that most homeschool parents want it. They're concerned that if there is public money for homeschool families, that eventually this might lead to additional accountability measures. So they were offered, I believe, $1,000 per student. Now, what's interesting here is that under a law that was passed back in 2009, 2010, the Taxpayer Transparency Act, the recipient of every tax credit in the state, with a couple of exceptions, the earned income tax credit or the child tax credit, that information, when you claim a tax credit, that information goes up on a website. So if you are a private school parent or homeschool parent claiming these credits that have been newly created, it is likely that that information will actually be reported and posted online by the tax commission. So there, that could be a concern for parents of homeschool kids and potentially for parents of private school children as well.
Well, I guess, you know, the thing that, and I was headed toward, and I take your point on them. They got pretty much everything they wanted here. I was willing to say the head, because I'm sure they want more before this is all said and done. But what worries me the most about this, you know way better than I know, that the Oklahoma economy historically is just boom bust. I mean, because we're so overly dependent on two basic industries, fossil fuels and ag. And we've seen in the last month, the state treasurer says that for the first time in 14 months, state revenues had dipped, which, you know, I'm not an economist. I don't know if that means we're heading down that slide again. But once these things are etched in law, they're nigh on impossible to get rid of, right?
Pretty much. They've put one safeguard regarding the new private school tax credits, where they say that if there are revenue shortfalls and there are budget cuts to appropriated agencies, that the amount of the tax credit will be cut by the same amount. Now, whether that actually
is that a
happens,
serious guardrail, though? I mean,
I can't, the reason I say,
remember when you couldn't take any money that we made off of gambling, off horse, you know, pari-mutuel gambling, and all those sorts of things? Any of the money that's gravy to the schools. You can't just, you know, you can't cut them and use that to fill in. But of course, that didn't exactly work out that way either, right?
Yeah, in terms of whether if parents send their kids to a private school and are expecting to get $7,500 back, I think it's very unlikely that the state will ever say, sorry, you're only going to get $6,400 or, you know, $5,500 or so on. I think that if push comes to shove, they will find a way to make sure that parents who come out and say, hey, we were told, even if the fine print may have said, beware that in the case of a shortfall, that the amount of your tax credit could be reduced. I'm skeptical that will ever happen. But there is that provision saying that if we do face, when we do face future shortfalls, because we always face periodic shortfalls, that the amount of the tax credits will, that the tax credit will take a haircut in the same way that appropriated funding for the Department of Education or higher ed or other agencies will get hit.
You know, it is interesting. It is interesting, right, to think about how committed Oklahoma Republicans are to President Biden's failure, right? And how much they would want to tie, because our congressional delegation is just, you know, they're always slamming President Biden, his administration, can't give him any credit for anything. So it's really interesting that, you know, that there's kind of this denial that there will ever be enough of a revenue shortfall to put a stop on these tax credits, given how much they want President Biden to fail. You know what I mean? You see what I'm saying? Like, it's kind of funny, though. It's like, well, what if it does happen? And what if we do have this recession that all the naysayers have been talking about? You know, it was like just right around the corner, right? The next jobs report, oh, it's going to be like this massive Great Recession times two. So, you know, are they maybe just passing this so they can say they did? And then, oh, you know, President Biden's recession came and up, nothing we can do. I mean, but I think you're right. I don't think they're ever going to be like, sorry, can't give you that tax credit. Economy's bad.
I think there's probably a lot of contradictory thoughts going into things. I think,
of course.
You know, we haven't talked about the outstanding issues in the session, which is the passage of an overall budget, and they still don't have a overall budget. And by, you know, most accounts, the sticking point at this point are tax cuts, with the governor and House Speaker McCall being enthusiastic about tax cuts, and the Senate, and specifically Appropriations Chair Roger Thompson, being a lot more cautious and bringing up the example of where we were not that long ago, 2016, 2017, you know, where we were facing $500 million shortfalls, then $800 million, and then one year it was $1.3 billion shortfall. And, you know, some of those veteran legislators who lived through that pure hell of trying to balance a budget the last time we were facing significant shortfalls are, I think, sincerely and wisely urging caution, saying, you know, looking to those revenue reports showing that revenue growth seems to be slowing or maybe even reversing. I think it's too early to say that, you know, we're going to be facing imminent budget shortfalls, but we don't know how the economy is going to do over the next year. And there are certainly signs to be concerned, you know, the Fed having raised interest rates multiple times to try to slow down inflation could very well help provoke a recession over the next, or a downturn over the next 12 months. So that could happen. And it's possible that, you know, even before the tax credits take effect, that they will not, people will not be eligible for the full amount because we might be facing revenue shortfalls.
So we're sitting on this pot of gold right now, a combination of factors, but primarily a strong rebound from COVID, right, and then this massive infusion of federal dollars
right
into the state. And I can't find any evidence in Oklahoma history, but I'm certainly not, you know, don't proclaim myself an Oklahoma history expert, even though I've lived most of my life here. But I don't think we've ever had anything quite like this at our beck and call. And yet I just get this sense that the legislature and the state house leadership doesn't quite know what to do with it. And it seems like there are lots of missed opportunities here to really do some things that would put Oklahoma in a much more favorable position for generations to come. Am I living in a fantasy world on that? Is it not nearly as impressive as I think it is, and the opportunity that as great as I think it is?
You know, I've been working on the state budget for over 25 years now, which there has to be a medal in the mail. But I was on fiscal staff and then, you know, spent better part of two decades as a advocate working on budget issues. And you're absolutely right. This is an unprecedented situation in terms of how much money we have, both in terms of year-to-year growth revenue and then money that has been squirreled away in different funds. It's really hard to get your arms around a solid number. They talk about $6 billion in savings, but it's hard to know exactly which pots go, you know, add up into that. But there's a bunch of money that's been saved in cash, and we have our two reserve funds are at their constitutionally capped limits. And then there's hundreds of millions of dollars for the Medicaid program because the state was benefiting from a higher federal match rate over the course of the pandemic. So there's, you know, $600 million there. There's a lot of money this year. And I think we're probably going to have to wait until after session when the dust has settled, which is now looking like it may not be until mid to late June before we really know what all they do. But they do seem to be looking at some long-term investment kind of possibilities. They're certainly looking at, you know, major incentive programs to try to get new plants to the state, which are, you know, in renewables, solar and batteries and electric. And so that's would help diversify and move us away from fossil fuel economy. They're talking about potentially a couple hundred million dollars for a to support housing programs a pool of money for housing construction, potentially some significant money for transportation above the 8-year plan. They're talking about potentially a new investment savings account that could be used to provide zero interest or low interest loans. So, you know, I do think that there's some interesting and probably reasonable and fiscally defensible solutions out there. I would certainly prefer to see many of those proposals pursued than one more lopping off of 0.25% or 0.5% or more of our top income tax rate, because that, I hope that we can conclude that we've done that now for 15, 20 years, and it really doesn't make us a more thriving, prosperous state.
You would think, I mean, we have no better example than Kansas. Kansas seemed to learn its lesson a lot faster than we did on this whole thing. You know, Brownback runs the thing into a ditch, and they changed course and said, no, this is, trickle down does not work. And yet here we are, we continue to do, you know, the old definition of insanity, the same thing over and over again and expect a different result. And I just, you know, I don't get it. You would think at some point, you know, what they're selling to voters, the voters would say, I'm not buying that anymore. It really hasn't worked for me. And the tax cuts, as we know, disproportionately benefit the bigger checkbooks.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting on the encourage, you're right. It is frustrating that year after year after year after year, they come back and say, we need to further reduce the top income tax rate, and we need to further cut the corporate income tax. Mm-hmm. And as you said, these are measures that primarily benefit the highest income households that don't need help. They provide very little or nothing to medium, middle income Oklahomans, and generally nothing at all to the poorest 20-40%.
No, keep going. Sorry.
So the more, you know, more optimistic way of looking at it is, one, we're still hearing voices. This year, it's been clearly the Senate Appropriations Chair and Senate in general who are much more skeptical about tax cuts and are really trying to keep their foot on that brake as much as possible. So it's not like all the powers that be are fighting over the biggest tax cuts. So I think, you know, we have to give the Senate in particular some credit for that. The other thing is they're not hearing a big clamoring for tax cuts from their constituents. I don't think any legislator is standing up and saying, I'm getting calls from my small business owners or farmers or teachers or doctors or nurses saying, cut my taxes. I think this is really something that is coming entirely from the legislature itself, that they sort of pull open the Republican legislative handbook, and there it is on page one, cut taxes. And then they turn to page two and it says cut taxes. And if they keep flipping through the pages, the handbook says cut taxes, cut taxes. And it's almost as if they're doing it because it's just a habit they can't break. And, you know, clearly some of their strongest interest groups and donors are happy enough for them to do it. But it's not like there's a big anti-tax, you know, this is not California in the 1970s with, you know, Howard Jarvis's anti-tax movement. There's no grassroots anti-tax movement in Oklahoma at this point.
So I have a couple concerns. I mean, just really about like the practicality of these tax credits specifically, because I'm just thinking, you know, who is actually going to be able to access these tax cuts, right? And I mean that from a purely practical standpoint. So, you know, when we had to go to my daughter's IEP meetings, they'd always have to tell us about the Lindsay Nicole scholarship. I mean, that was just the pro forma of every IEP meeting. So absent that, you know, I mean, I can't really think of people who don't have tax advisors or CPAs filing their taxes for them. You know, and then there's the people who aren't like us, who don't sit at the edge of their seat to see what the legislature is going to do, you know, who really aren't just constantly reading and imbibing all this news. You know, how easy is it going to be for the vast majority, like you said, 40% plus of Oklahomans, one, to even know about these tax credits, and two, to file them? I mean, I guess I'm gathering, you know, that the actual documentation that you'll have to be provide will be minimal.
Right.
You know, but I mean, it's like taxes are not an easy thing.
Right. So there's, I mean, two almost conflicting concerns about these new education tax credits. Either they're going to be too hard to claim or too easy to claim. If they're too easy to claim, then it raises questions about what is the oversight, what kind of accountability is in place to make sure that families claiming the tax credit are actually attending a private school, that their tuition, that they're paying more in tuition and other eligible expenses, you know, an amount equal to or more than they're eligible for the tax credit. And certainly the House and Senate Democrats and some others have pointed to the whole EPIC fiasco and, you know, all the financial wrongdoing that was uncovered there to raise some concerns about whether the tax commission or anyone will have the capacity to provide proper oversight to make sure that people are claiming the tax credits properly. The other concern that more in line with what you brought up, Marianne, is will people who are eligible for it be able to claim it? And I'm, my sense will be that the financial officers of every private school will work very hard, and they'll bring extra people on because this is going to be like a big windfall for the schools, to make sure that students and prospective students are aware of this and know how to apply and can get assistance that they need, so that if their child is attending a school, you know, private school, that they can go ahead and claim their $7,500 tax credit. My guess is, I mean, that's a pretty substantial amount, and you know, most of the students already attending private schools are more affluent and they do have accountants. If it's, you know, if they do actually succeed in attracting those low-income families that they're always claiming these credits are intended for, they probably need to provide some assistance so people know how to claim and get the money back.
I mean, I'm really skeptical. I'm honestly very skeptical that people from all over every part of Oklahoma City, for instance, are going to be clamoring to find out how to get their kids into Heritage Hall. You know what I mean? I don't see it happening, and I don't think it's just a financial standpoint, right?
Nor do we think the schools are going to be necessarily welcoming those
folks. Right. You know, and the fact is, when they did the fiscal estimates on the bill and they tried to calculate how much for example, $5,000 tax credit with no income eligibilities, how much that would cost, they looked at the existing population attending private schools and didn't figure in that any new students were going to attend private school as a result. So to the extent that that's true, then we're simply subsidizing people who are already sending
I mean, to the extent
that it's not true, to the extent that it actually does serve to provide enough of a financial incentive so that more lower income families or lower middle class families do send their kids to private school, then the cost of the tax credit program could be exponentially more. But I don't believe that we're going to see tens of thousands of families pull their kids out of public schools to go to private schools. The money just will not be enough. And this is not what they're looking for. I think most families are looking for better funded public schools with better resources and more experienced teachers and so on.
I mean, when you can have your neighborhood school or you have to ship your kid across town, I know there are people that do that, right? You know, there's people in Norman who send their kids to Mount St. Mary's all the way up to Heritage Hall, which, oh my God, why would you, you know, send your kid on a 1 hour one way? Why? But, and then just a few quick numbers. Like, I just feel like the socioeconomic, shall we say, cultural understandings, you know, between, you know, the folks who will go to a private school for versus a lot of public schools. I don't think there's going to be a lot of us clamoring to send our kids to a private school, right? And then let's say there's, you know, tens of thousands of families who decide they want to send their kids to private schools. Those private schools still have to raise the capital to expand their facilities, just like any other school, right? I mean, there's so many impossibilities here. But then I just pulled up really quick, you know, how many private schools are in Oklahoma? There's 220, just roughly. And then, you know, the some information on the Lindsay Nicole scholarships, which is again for kids who are served under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. So it's a subset of students, right, who theoretically aren't being served by their public schools, which, yes, that's a problem. I've been there. But there was 1,135 students received scholarships for the Lindsay Nicole Henry. But only 83 private schools have been approved to participate, which means there's probably only been 83 that have signed up, you know? So if you look at the uptake of these benefits, the private school is willing to accept these benefits and these dollars, you know, meaning they then have to accept those students, you know? I mean, the proof may come out in the pudding, right? Whenever these things take up. So I just think we have a whole bunch of class issues that are just going to be very apparent very quickly by what rates of uptake we have with people actually applying, wanting to send their kids to private schools miles away from home, finding the extra cash to cover the cost of some of these private schools. But then again, which we've all pointed out, the reluctance of these private schools to accept any further students, right? And I think the homeschool population really kind of has it, like what Senator Hamilton said, you know, and I will never forget this when he was like, with the shekels come the shackles, right? They don't want those regulations. They don't want that oversight. It's kind of antithetical to how they operate. But I don't know, there's just so many problems here that I'm like, I think they're doing it just to say they do it. And like you've said, David, to give the tax benefits to the wealthiest amongst us already.
Absolutely. You know, if they were intent on a program that was really geared towards offering expanding opportunities to private schools for children who are not being well served in their public school, then they would expand. That's what the Lindsay Nicole Henry Scholarship does. You have to be a student in a public school first on an IEP and then transfer. They could have put in a similar provision, and they could also say it would only be, you know, up to $75,000 family income, or $100,000 family income, or
What you could also do? You could also raise the cap for children eligible under Sooner Care to receive services that have IEPs, right? Like, absolutely.
You could do various things. That is not really the goal. The goal, at least the way that it ended up playing out is we are going to cover a significant part of the tuition, and it depends on the schools. You know, there are some church schools that are fairly modestly priced, and then there are some, you know, the Casha Halls and Holland Halls in Tulsa that are much more expensive, that more resemble a, you know, the tuition of a private university. And we're going to cover, so you're, you know, you've been paying $14,000 a year, and congratulations, your tuition has just been cut in half. That's what really they're doing. And it's going to be $150 million this year, then $200 million, then $250 million, because they've already put into the legislation that the cap will grow. So within 2 years, it's going to be $250 million a year, at least. Well, that's where the cap will be, to primarily subsidize private school tuition for students already attending.
So tell me how kids and families in rural Oklahoma benefit from this program, because that's where the big change is this year. Somehow the speaker has flipped on this whole topic, and we could speculate about why that is and his political ambition, but how he convinced all these other rural legislators to go along with this giveaway, basically, when I don't see how they benefit. Their constituents benefit.
You know, I think that's where you have to look at the various parts of the education agreements as a single package that got broken out into sort of two main parts. And without question, the House in particular was skeptical about private school vouchers or tax credits, because they're aware that this was going to be a benefit to urban areas or families in urban areas, much less in rural areas. And so the question was, what are we going to do for rural schools? And I think the House Republican caucus was adamant that they were not going to go along on vouchers unless something was done for rural schools, rural public schools as well. And there was a, you know, several month long acrimonious fight, primarily between the House and the Senate, over what to do. And there was, they called it the Oklahoma student fund or something. It was going to be $300 million allocated outside of the formula, with every school district guaranteed at least $1 million. And there were some, you know, pretty good analysis put out by Senate Democrats, among others, showing that, you know, that would mean $60 per student in Tulsa public schools and Oklahoma City public schools. But if you looked at some of the rural areas, it's going to be 5 and 10 times as much per student. And the Senate really balked at that and said they were not going to go along with that. What ultimately got done, there were three measures that were part of the education package that got announced earlier this week that are going to particularly benefit rural schools. So one was an adjustment to the funding formula, the state aid formula, to increase the weights for transportation and for small schools. So that's going to help rural schools. A second provision is a pot of money that's been called the School Safety Fund, to make sure that every district is able to hire a school resource officer. And under that provision, every school district is assured, I think, at least $96,000 a year in funding for related to school security. So those were two things that were done for rural schools. And I feel like Governor Rick Perry here, I can't remember the third, So I'm just going to say, oops, and I'm not going to be the Republican nominee for president either. But it will come. There was the third thing that was also
done. Pull me once, David. Pull me.
There was a third thing that was also done that's going to have a disproportionate benefit for rural schools. Oh, I know what it is. It was the Red Butt Fund, which is a provision that was enacted a couple of years ago initially with money from medical marijuana. Now there's going to be general revenue. This is focused on schools that have less property money, specific for building and construction efforts. And they're adding $125 million to that fund. And that will also, it's going to help hundreds of districts, but it's going to primarily benefit rural districts and brick and mortar charter schools.
But the long term on these three areas that you're talking about, the tweak in the fund, the school funding formula,
yep,
seems like, you know, it could have a long term impact. But the rest of this is at the discretion annually of the legislature, and it's interesting, right? I mean, and so.
Right. Right.
So the fact that this legislature has in effect tied the hands of future legislatures, and I always thought that that was something you weren't supposed to be able to do, but yeah, in terms of what's going to be allowed, you know, from 150 million to 200 million to 250 million. And yet when it comes to public ed, there's no similar guarantees.
Sure. But there's nothing, I'm not particularly shocked by that, you know, even the other thing they did, which we haven't really talked about, is the teacher pay raise. So mm-hmm. they're providing a pay raise of $3,000 to $6,000 for every certified teacher or, you know, guidance counselor, librarian, and so on, other professionals. You can make the same argument. Are they tying the hands of future legislators to say that by raising the minimum salary? Yes and no. You know, everything that you do in statute that obligates certain money, it may not be there next year. But I think we can assume that there may need to be tweaks, but you know, I think that the funding is pretty solid for the teacher pay raise, for the increases in the formula. There was like another $214 million that's going to go into the state funding formula. I know some districts are going to look to raise salaries for support personnel with that money. There's the Red Butt Fund, there's school security, there's other things. We could, you know, find ourselves in a major downturn, and all that might need to get cut back a little bit. But I think that, you know, these will be sort of the basic building blocks that the legislature will have in place for future years.
Is that enough to offset the commitment to private school vouchers? I hate to use tax.
It's
a voucher to me. It's a tax expenditure.
Yeah, it's a tax expenditure. So, you know, I think probably the fairest way to look at what was done is that there was about $800 million committed to education, $150 million of it in the form of private school tax credits, with that money set to increase in the next 2 years, and then another $625 million or so that will get allocated through the appropriations process for all these various commitments, teacher raises, the Red Butt Fund, school safety, some literacy, and a couple of other smaller things.
But percentage-wise, a whole lot more went to private education than public education.
Well, if you were talking to a Republican legislator, they would say $625 million in additional funding for public schools and $150 million in tax credits for private schools. They could say, you know, 80% of the new money went to public schools. The problem is that we have had a century-long commitment in this country to separation of church and state and to not using public dollars to fund private schools. And I think this is a clear violation of that previously sacred principle. If we are going to cut parents a $7,500 check for sending their child to a church-run private school, that there's no way of looking at this anything other than a private religious school. So that's, you know, that's where we've sort of crossed over what had previously been a, well, it had been a pretty clear line before. The line had already started to blur in a bunch of ways, and now we've just erased the line entirely. The state of Oklahoma will be funding public schools through the appropriations process and funding private schools through the tax code.
Well, and missed not too long after the voters in Oklahoma made very clear that they did not want public dollars going for sectarian purposes.
Well, funny you should say that. You know, there is, in fact, under Oklahoma's constitution, a way for the voters of Oklahoma to weigh in on this. We have a veto referendum process, which means that on most legislation, including the tax credit bill that has passed the legislature and is heading to the governor, which was House Bill 1936, you have 90 days after the end of session to file a veto petition. It takes 5% of signatures of 5% of the voters in the last gubernatorial election. It's about 56,000 people who'd have to sign a petition. And if they can collect the signatures and go through all the stages and not run into, you know, legal problems with the petition, then that would get put to a vote of the people to either affirm the legislation or to veto the legislation. So there actually is an opportunity for the voters to weigh in on this. And, you know, I would not be totally shocked if I were to hear that folks are having conversations about whether this is something that, you know, could be considered. And they have some time. It's 90 days after adjournment. So you would have from, you know, if they adjourn next Friday, you basically have until the end of August to submit a petition effort and to collect the signatures.
My theory, you know, and of course I was referring to the state question a few years ago that cemented, Oklahoma's views on that, but I hadn't even given thought to the veto referendum, which is quite an interesting and provocative thought on all this. But I thought throughout this process, when they seem to be at loggerheads on these different things, if they're absolutely so convinced that they've been given a mandate to do this, then why not separate that out and have the legislature send it to a vote of the people right then and there to say what, you know.
I mean, I think there was no chance that the legislature was going to do this.
Because they knew it would fail.
They know it would fail.
Yeah. So much for the mandate.
Right. Now, if there is a veto petition on what is now House Bill 1936, we can assume that the school choice proponents, and there are state groups, Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs being the most prominent one, and national groups that would sink millions of dollars into a campaign. So any effort to launch and fight a veto campaign would require substantial money. And, you know, I don't think it's in any way automatic. I think, you know, it would have to, it would require some serious conversations with who's going to fund it, who's going to organize it, who's going to run it. But at the same time, you know, and I haven't seen any polling, and I don't know that any polling has been done, but my guess is if you did a poll and sort of gave the outlines of the legislation, that, you know, the legislature has passed a bill to provide a $7,500 tax credit to families to send their children to public schools, I'm guessing it wouldn't poll so great. So there's some opportunities.
Well, the fat lady hasn't sung yet, to use a terrible phrase, but, you know, I mean, this isn't quite over the finish line, right? So.
Right. Actually, the voucher bill has not gone to the governor yet, as far as I know. I think we can say with close to certainty that
he's going to sign
the tax credits are going to get signed by the governor. And that the only way to stop them would be through a veto campaign.
Thank you so much for your time. This is invaluable insights, and there's no other expert like it in the state. So thank you.
Well, I enjoyed it and be happy to come back on.
Thank you so much.
All right. So yeah, and Martin.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ObserverCast. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and share our episodes far and wide on social media. If you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, please give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org. You can also support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. And to help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the Donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in its 55th year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year. That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate. And finally, we want to thank Jared Deck for the music you're listening to in the background here. He's not just a resident of Norman anymore. He is now the Oklahoma State Representative for House District 44. Congratulations, Representative Deck. We're so proud of you. But you can still download his albums at iTunes and learn more, including dates for any upcoming performances at jareddeckmusic.com.